The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Florence Nash from the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I'm going to be reading to you from AARP Magazine, the June-July 2019 issue. And I think we'll start off today with the cover article, which is on actor Jeff Daniels and his new Broadway play, a production of To Kill a Mockingbird. This article is titled Remaking an Icon. And it is written by Alex Wilkinson, who has been a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine since 1980 and is the author of 10 books. Remaking an Icon. 8 days a week, Jeff Daniels steps onto a Broadway stage as Atticus Finch in an acclaimed new production of To Kill a Mockingbird. It's a role Gregory Peck has owned for over 50 years. How did Daniels craft an Atticus who speaks to a modern audience? Jeff Daniels, who is 64, likes to imagine celebrating his 80th birthday with a dinner party attended by all the characters he's ever played. So far, the guest list is nearly 90 names long, including Will McAvoy, the arrogant anchor from the HBO series The Newsroom, Flap Horton, the spineless husband from Terms of Endearment, and the sublimely imbecile Harry Dunn from Dumb and Dumber. The most prominent figure on the list, however, and likely still to be so in 16 years, is Atticus Finch, the saintly protagonist of To Kill a Mockingbird, whom Daniels plays currently on Broadway. Atticus, as he's known even to his children, is significant in an unusual way, says Daniels. He is a fictional hero so iconic that some people think he's real. To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee is as close to ubiquitous as a novel is likely to get. Set in the imaginary town of Macon, Alabama, in the 1930s, it was published in 1960 and has never been out of print. In 1962, the book was made into a movie starring Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch, a movie that has never been remade. Peck's portrayal of the idealistic, brooding attorney established the character so effectively that generations of Americans tend to picture his face when they think of Atticus. Peck's height and his upright, laconic manner subtly suggest a young Abraham Lincoln in a small town courtroom lawyering for truth. Lee embraced the portrayal. Although she authorized a stage adaptation of her novel in 1969, that version was only for schools and community theaters. She refused to approve it for the professional stage. As she explained to Peck in a letter in the 1980s, I've refused scores of requests from some mightily talented people to turn M. Bird into everything from a Broadway play to an opera. I have always said no for one reason. I cannot run the risk of having your Atticus diminished in public memory by so much as a scintilla. Not long before Lee died, however, in 2016, she agreed to sell the stage rights to the Broadway producer Scott Rudin, who hired Aaron Sorkin to write the script. Sorkin, who is known for terse dialogue, wrote the screenplays for A Few Good Men and The Social Network, and he was also the creator of TV's The West Wing and The Newsroom. He asked Daniels if he would care to play Atticus, and Daniels agreed. I've never been one to start weeping at a moment like that, the actor said recently, so I said, should I read the book? It was my way of saying, I need to hear you say that again. A version of Atticus for the 21st century would need to be more complex than the one Peck portrayed. The Lee estate had insisted that Sorkin's Atticus would not drink or take the Lord's name in vain, but the new play's hero is less monochromatically honorable than the one in the 1962 film, and more sensitive to the feelings of others, especially his black housekeeper, Calpurnia. Whereas Peck's Atticus was naive about whether a jury would reach a just verdict, Daniels' version is skeptical. Daniels knew the enduring impression that Peck's Atticus had made, but felt he needed to construct his own version of the character. You can't go out there thinking, Peck did this, I'm going to do this, Daniels said. Obscene actors have to deal with signature roles, and sometimes they choose to do exactly the opposite of the original, and I'm not sure that works. While he talked, Daniels sat at a table beside a window in a cafe in New York City. It was the middle of the morning. He is a tall, sturdily built man with the mild, unassuming look of someone who might be a little league coach admired for his commitment to fair play. The actor grew up in Chelsea, Michigan, about 40 miles west of Detroit, where his father, Bob, owned a lumber company and for a while was the mayor. Daniels went to Central Michigan University until 1976, his junior year, when he moved to New York to be an actor. In 1979, he married Kathleen Trado, who was also from Chelsea, and in 1986, they moved back home to raise three children. He continued to work in New York and found success in Hollywood, too. Daniels has won several Tony and Emmy Awards and been nominated for four Golden Globe Awards. He started the Purple Rose Theater Company in Chelsea and is an accomplished guitar player, singer, and songwriter. Daniels spent a summer memorizing the script for Mockingbird. Actors don't usually arrive at first rehearsals with a script memorized, but Daniels did, because, quote, "the profile of this thing was so big that I wanted to be prepared," end quote. Whatever anxiety he felt about appearing in Peck's shadow, he overcame by doing what his upbringing had trained him to do. "If you want to combat nerves, be more prepared," he said. "It's the Midwestern work ethic." To play Atticus, Daniels also studied the history of Southern towns. He read Go Set a Watchman, the novel Lee wrote before Mockingbird and which was controversial when it was finally published in 2015, because its Atticus is a far less sympathetic figure. In addition, he read biographies of Harper Lee and watched videos of Frank Johnson, a legendary federal judge in Alabama whose rulings in the 1950s and 1960s helped end legal segregation. "He put KKK guys in jail when it was easier not to," Daniel said. "He also had a great accent to model my own on. So a year ago, I was walking around the lake speaking like Frank Johnson." Daniels paused and then said drowsily, "A registered colt of law." As Mockingbird begins, Atticus is appointed to defend Tom Robinson, an African-American man accused of rape by Mayella Ewell, a young white woman who lives with her violent alcoholic father and seven siblings in a shack by the town dump. Robinson has helped Ewell with chores in the past, but he did not attack her, which Atticus demonstrates conclusively in court. Robinson is doomed, though, when he says he helped Ewell because he felt sorry for her. Pity for a white woman by a black man, however lowly or forlorn the woman's circumstances, was forbidden by consensus in Alabama in the 1930s. The jury finds Robinson guilty, and Atticus is left deeply shaken. While Peck's Atticus represents virtues that are timeless, he is perhaps too simplistic to be a modern figure, just as "I Want to Hold Your Hand" is too simple to be a modern love song. His Atticus is modest, fierce, brilliant, austere, and self-contained. Though people need him, he doesn't need other people. Daniel's version has a broader range of feeling and a decided warmth. Peck's morality is stern, and Daniel's is benevolent. Peck's version is wounded by his having lost his wife to a heart attack, but he can't express the full extent of his emotions, whereas Daniel's version is passionate. Plus, Daniels has a deft comic touch, especially in dealing with children, whereas Peck's Atticus has the remoteness of a lighthouse. Peck's portrayal is, in addition, from the era when American movie heroes were tight-lipped white men thrown into conflict by the force of their beliefs, men who met danger courageously and hoped to persuade by their example. Such heroes were aspirational as much as realistic. Daniels's Atticus, by contrast, seems to be shadowed by the awareness that doing all he can might not be enough. Along with the rest of us, he seems to share the modern awareness that life is possibly too complex and too many interests are at stake for a single moral stance to answer all situations. As we talked, a waitress brought Daniels more coffee. Speaking of his preparation, he said, "You let it all cascade over you. You think, what do you need to do to feel like you are inhabiting him? And in the end, what I wanted was to see what Atticus saw when he stood on his porch." "Does your version draw on anyone you know?" I asked. My dad was very much an Atticus, in that there was a right way to do something and there were all the other ways, he said. He lived like that. Creating a convincing Atticus also involves the trick of living within him as the play unfolds. "As Atticus," I asked, "do you know if Tom Robinson is going to lose?" "It's not 100% he's going to lose, but I'm going up a steep hill as I start the closing argument," Daniel said. "You have to convince a jury of white farmers about the innocence of a black man in Alabama in 1935. They are all sitting there with their arms folded and staring at you. You're swimming upstream. You're getting more and more frustrated. You keep looking to the jury box and you finish angry. Angry at Tom for making his mistake. Angry at the judge for giving you this task. Angry at losing." Daniels looked out the window at a woman pushing a stroller. "Atticus believes in the law," he went on. "He can't believe that there are people who do what these people, his neighbors, are about to do in finding Tom guilty." He paused to consider a thought. "Here's the other thing about all of this," he said next. "I'm working harder than in any decade of my life," which is not how they draw it up in Star School. "Acting is craft. And when you get roles like I've had lately, you need everything you've ever learned to pull them off. I find myself using things I learned years ago. I tell drama kids, find out what you want to do and spend the rest of your life getting better at it. And that still is the case, I find, at 64. Another benefit of extravagant preparation is that it has given his performance a freedom it wouldn't otherwise have had. Since you know your part cold, you're able to follow the impulse that just occurred to you," he said. "The art and craft comes from not chasing impulses that are inappropriate or wrong or ruin the scene. You learn how to make the choice. The only way you can get there, though, is time. A long career. I didn't think it would be like that. It's pretty cool being in the moment, enjoying every moment. Perhaps that's too Pollyanna, but I find myself not in such a hurry to be done with what I'm doing. Besides," he said, as the waitress cleared the table, "being Atticus is a pretty good way to spend the night." And here's a little sidebar for the article. A book for our time. It's one of our nation's most revered texts, and it's probably the book that has most shaped our collective understanding of the evils of Jim Crow. With sales of more than 40 million copies since its publication in 1960, Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird appears frequently on surveys as one of the most important books in Americans' lives. It's a high school English staple, the book that's most assigned to 9th and 10th graders, according to one 2012 survey. "The novel is secular scripture," argues Harper Lee scholar Casey Sepp. "It's one of only a handful of texts most Americans have in common. Mockingbird first appeared in a tumultuous era when African Americans were organizing to demand desegregation and equal rights, and the story's rebirth on the Broadway stage at the end of last year arrives at another fractious time, a time when a new Mockingbird for a new age feels like just the thing we need." Now I'm going to backpedal a little bit and read the editor-in-chief's sort of opening editorial in AARP. "Between Us," by Robert Love, editor-in-chief. "A new age is here. Living fuller, better lives, we have stories to tell. Around the world, people are living longer and healthier, which presents possibilities and challenges unparalleled in human history. At AARP, to mark the close of our 60th anniversary year, we set out to document the breadth of the changes and tell the human stories behind them. We partnered with the photojournalism agency Magnum Photos to bring you images of new ways of aging around the world. Magnum, a prestigious international cooperative whose contributors have included Ansel Adams and Dorothea Lange, sent 22 photographers to 27 locations on 6 continents, capturing scenes of life after 50 that could only be happening now. For our project, which we've called A New Age, these photojournalists logged 174,500 miles, bringing home more than 1,500 images to show us what aging looks like in 13 countries. Naturally, the changes we are talking about are most clearly manifest in people. We are living more engaged, active lives in new permutations of family tradition, work, and play. For instance, with multi-generational living declining in Japan and China, elders care for one another in new social networks, as seen in a ballroom dancing club in Chongqing. In Mosul, Iraq, a grandmother in her 60s tends to 22 of her grandchildren in the aftermath of a brutal war that claimed the lives of 4 of her children and a son-in-law. Women, we found, are rising up in new roles in unlikely places. Jennifer Riria, born into poverty, became the CEO of a major Kenyan development institution. She has changed the lives of over 3 million African women with small loans, savings accounts, and insurance. And in our own country, a later life model shows what it means to be beautiful at every age. For this project, which began in October 2017, more than 110 subjects ages 50 to 104 were photographed for the portfolio. Many more photos, videos, and expanded stories can be found online at aarp.org/newage. and curated on Facebook and other social feeds. In fact, we devoted this issue to the subject of how aging has changed, what it means now and in the future. Regarding health, for example, we discovered that scientists are close to introducing a groundbreaking daily pill that promises to extend good health to age 100 and beyond. Living longer entails financial challenges, of course. How do you support yourself, even in your most vulnerable years? And how do you invest your hard-earned savings in roiling and unpredictable markets? We've asked 7 experts to provide advice on where to put your money based on what you believe the future holds. And actor Jeff Daniels tells how he has reinvented the beloved hero of To Kill a Mockingbird for a new American era. There's a lot to learn and enjoy in this trove of reporting. It's part of our mission to provide news and information to empower you to choose how you live as you enter this new age. Now, before we leave show business figures, here's an interview with actress Laura Linney. What I Know Now, the versatile actress on History's Lessons, Motherhood, and Cartwheels. Power Prep. I'm meticulous. In college, I taped my lectures and at the end of the day listened to them and took very detailed notes. Now I need to work thoroughly, sinking into the script, learning. It's time-consuming, but I've always enjoyed it. Tales of the City, 2019. I was keen to return to my character from the 1990s series to pass the story of her adventures in San Francisco on to the next generation of LGBTQ people and their straight friends. The author of the book series, Armistead Maupin, has been a great friend for 25 years. I named my son after him. Having a son at 49. I love being a mother. I'm so grateful to have had that experience. He's 5 and watches TV occasionally, but I love that his default is to go to a book. History nerd. When I was playing Abigail Adams, I read a book about John Adams and was like, oh, Jefferson, he's interesting, and I read a book about him, and then likewise one about Monroe, and then Madison. It just unfolds, and this whole architecture of America is revealed. Another must-read. Eleanor Roosevelt shared her philosophy of life in her book, You Learn by Living. It's a passing down of a personal history and lessons, large and small, like we do not have to become heroes overnight, just a step at a time. On a fave co-star. I love working with Liam Neeson. We worked as husband and wife in The Crucible, Kinsey, and The Other Man, and we were in Love Actually. You're able to start at a much deeper level when you are with someone whom you've worked with a lot. Tragedy and comedy. My series, The Big C, was a comedy, but about someone with terminal cancer. Comedy is a survival technique. When things are overwhelming, when you're in chaos, when you're really scared, it's a way to cope. Turning cartwheels. I haven't done a cartwheel since The Big C, but I bet I could. It's important to still feel connected to your body, even though it's changing drastically. Failure power. You learn more from failing than you do from succeeding. It's important to befriend failure. It's not pleasant and it's painful, but it's necessary to grow. I wish everyone a manageable failure at one point in life. You learn about grit and how to pull yourself out of a tough situation. Then, hopefully, you get things that are good. Now I consistently work, and I know that's rare, but for me, it's been so far, knock wood, a wonderful, wonderful life. This is as told to Tim Appello. 4-time Emmy winner Laura Linney, 55, stars in Netflix Ozark and Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City, which premiered on June 7. And now we'll turn to AARP's Money Saver section. Here's an article called Mind Over Money by Linda Stern. Even a genius can make poor financial decisions. Learn why and what you can do about it. Are you irrational about money? I know I am. I spent my working life saving for my retirement, but now that I'm retired, I can't switch gears and start spending what I've saved. I will drive across town to buy wine on sale and then spend more for a glass at a restaurant than I just spent on that bottle. I think the dollar in my savings account is worth a lot more than the dollar in my checking account, and I regard the dollar bill in my pocket as practically worthless. I'm weird, and that's normal. In fact, the vast majority of Americans are quirky about their money, so much so that an entire school of study about it, behavioral economics, has sprung up in the past 2 decades, its practitioners winning 3 Nobel Prizes along the way. Behavioral economists document our financial foibles and then propose ways we can psych ourselves into sounder money management. Some of our quirks are harmless. Keeping that dollar in my pocket out of my savings account cost me only a few pennies of interest a year. But some of our all-too-human behaviors can really hurt our bottom line. Here are a few of the most common idiosyncrasies these economists have discovered and ways we can protect ourselves from ourselves. 1. We get financial advice from butchers. Ken Robertson is an Austin, Texas retirement plan consultant who used to administer 401k plans for large companies. He noticed a particular behavior among employees in the plans, workers seeking money advice from colleagues they perceived as most skilled, even if the skill had nothing to do with money. At one Las Vegas hotel, the employees all respected the talents of the sushi chef and sought him out for retirement investment advice. At a large supermarket chain, butchers were typically deemed to be among the most skilled workers on site, and employees often turned to them for retirement guidance. Robertson and his colleagues used that information to bolster retirement savings. They targeted the sushi chef and the butchers for lessons on how bigger contributions built savings, knowing that other employees would ask for their advice. It worked. Retirement savings contributions went up company-wide, though individual workers might have done better to get true expert assistance or learn to manage their accounts themselves. But many of us also have a money quirk that goes in the opposite direction. When it's plausible that another person knows something about finances, we overestimate our ability to judge the quality of his or her advice. Harvard professor David Labson, a behavioral finance expert, laments that many people will buy high-fee mutual funds and insurance products from financial advisors without ever really understanding how much they are paying or what the impact will be on their savings. It's why near retirees still pack those free retirement seminars at restaurants, even though the advice is often dubious. The fix: get educated about your finances so you don't have to rely on any single expert. There's a wealth of good free info online. One place to start is research firm Morningstar's Investing Classroom, morningstar.com/cover/classroom.html. Several investment firms, including TD Ameritrade, Charles Schwab, and Vanguard, offer educational materials and calculators that can help with investing. If you want professional help, shop for a financial advisor who is a certified financial planner or is a certified public accountant with a personal finance specialist designation. Use an advisor who discloses fees and has fiduciary responsibility to put your interests first. Have a 401k at work? The company that operates it for your employer may also provide retirement planning advice. We are weird about our credit cards. When you have balances on multiple credit cards, mathematically there's just one correct way to minimize your total payments over a set period of time. Send all your extra money to the card with the highest interest rate until that card is paid off. Then focus on the one that has the next highest rate. Another school of thought, which focuses more on good psychology than pure math, is to pay off the smallest balance first, so you'll be energized by that quick achievement. But most people do neither, reports Neil Mahoney, a University of Chicago economics professor. They dole out money to different cards in proportion to how big the card balances are, his research found. That's because humans are uncomfortable betting on one thing, Mahoney says. We've heard we're not supposed to put all our eggs in one basket, and it makes us nervous to do so, even in situations such as credit card payoffs, where it makes the most sense. We're irrational in other ways with credit cards, too. Mahoney is now studying the common practice of carrying high-interest debt on credit cards, even when we have enough money in savings, often earning negligible interest, to pay it off. The fix? Focus like a laser on your high-interest card and send all the money you possibly can there until you burn the balance, and don't consider your savings account off-limits. Let's say you have a $2,000 balance on a card charging 18% interest, about the national average. Paying it down at the rate of $50 a month will cost you $1,077 in interest over the years. You're better off pulling $2,000 from your savings to pay the balance, then putting that $50 a month back into your savings account. If you have an emergency before you've saved enough to cover it, you can borrow on your card to cover it. You might also consider playing the balance transfer game. Move the balances from your high-interest cards to a new card offering a low, maybe 0%, introductory rate for a specified stretch of time, often a year. You'll probably pay a one-time fee of around 4%, but that will still buy you time to pay off the balance. Do this if you're comfortably convinced you'll be able to pay off the balance within the introductory period. And definitely don't convince yourself it's okay to run up a new balance on an old card. That would be self-defeating. And longtime journalist Linda Stern, the author of this article, is the former Wall Street and personal finance editor at Thomson Reuters. And now, it looks like we've just about run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you will come back and listen next week. I'm Florence Nash, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org, or I guess now it's northcarolinareadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138.